Let's never come here again, because it would never be as much fun.
Yours, mine, theirs.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs. And I'm going to apologize up front because this podcast is not very Yar.
Hi, everybody. I'm John, but I'm an alternate reality John, a reality where I have killer bangs.
Hello, my name is Brooke Heim, and I am so happy to be here, even if some of what I says does get lost in translation.
Excellent. Nice work, hey. Brooke. Way to think on the fly. We just told you, we made you do this like 5 seconds ago. You totally pulled through. That's why we love you, and that's why you're here.
Hey, we each picked a different movie, too, so that was great.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. So it's a good setting. So, And Brooke, before I forget, I just want to say, you know, you're... special guest from the years from the what's your podcast? Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye.
Yeah.
You people over there have been doing like Disney princesses, and I've been loving your takes on on Snow White especially. That was like really refreshing. Oh. It's been 70 years since I've seen the movie Snow White, but if there's one thing the movie needs, it's a defender, I suppose. And I think it's just great to hear you talk about that. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I never imagined in my entire life, and had you asked anyone in my family if I would be the one defending the princesses, they would not have said it would be me. But
yeah,
here we are, nonetheless.
Yeah, here we are. And I think you do it really well because when us in the podcasting community, and I've been podcasting, like Roy and I have been podcasting for so many years, and it's so weird to like watch stuff knowing that we're going to talk about it later, and because we kind of feel like, you know, homeworky, and it's like, what clever thing am I going to say here, and what hot take am I going to make here? And so often it's just like, hey, this isn't, you know, good for society, and this isn't this, and this isn't this, but I mean, so far with the princesses or whatever, you're making it so personal, which makes it so universal. So,
I have a... sometimes I think I'm good for podcasts, but then other times I listen to the rest of the group, and I'm like, oh, they really... like, they're doing research while they watch, and I am 100% just immersed in the films. For good or for bad, right? Like, if I love them, I'm experiencing them. If I hate them, I'm experiencing them. And then I kind of, like, jot down some notes afterwards, but... I really try to just watch and see how I'm enjoying it and go from there. I'm not a professional.
Yeah, no, I think that's what it takes. I think as Steve Martin says in those masterclass commercials that always interrupt my Instagram feed, sometimes the workaround will lead you to somewhere original, which I think often happens. So,
yeah.
By the way, if you're joining this podcast for the first time, which would be really weird... but if you are, we're going to talk about The Philadelphia Story, Sliding Doors, and Lost in Translation. The deal with this podcast is we pick a real weird, specific category.
What do these have in common?
And we watch three movies. And what these three movies have in common is our guest, Brooke, has decided that these movies gave birth to Brooke. So here we are.
Here we are.
Yeah.
And they gave birth to me at very different times in my life. And so that's kind of why I collected them.
So when you were really young and The Philadelphia Story had just come out?
Philadelphia Story was very much an influence of mine in high school, actually.
Huh.
I didn't have many friends, so I was sitting at home and I was watching AMC and it came on and it was just... it was an experience like you didn't see in theater anymore. And it was so poignant and hit me so emotionally and impactfully that it has always stuck with me.
So we want to jump right in. So Philadelphia Story is a fascinating movie, and it's an old movie. I'm not complaining, but this is like barely 1940, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's it. So we're just going to start. By the way, The Philadelphia Story 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. I have no idea how much it cost, but it only made $400,000. But in 1940 dollars, that's probably like $500 million or something.
Yeah.
So,
It should have made it. Million should have crossed the million barrel barrier, I would think.
It did not.
Interesting.
It didn't cross the half million barrier, John.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, let me sum it up real quick, okay?
Right.
So Katharine Hepburn plays underage porn star Tracy Lords.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and back then what guys really liked was enormous pockets on your blouse. That was the sexy stuff. So, and that's pretty much it. Am I reading this? So no, but it's is that where Tracy Lord got her name from? Was she like when she was 15 and decided she was going to do adult films, she thought, I really love the Philadelphia Story.
That'd be interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's a kindred spirit there, Brooke. Like someone else in high school who was like...
Right, like once I figured out who the other Tracy Lords was, I was like, I wonder. That would be really neat.
Okay, so the real story. We have Katharine Hepburn's character, Tracy, and she is about to get married to a guy who's like dry toast, right? He's just nothing. He's a nothing. But the point is that she's not just that she's getting married, but she's divorced and getting married again. She used to be married to, what's his name? C.K. Walter William. C.K. Dexter, right? I'm missing part of his name. He's got 10 names.
He's been married a lot.
C.K. Dexter Lewis? No, it's not Lewis. Dang it, now you threw me off.
Okay, where's my... Let's see. I can't find it. The point is, they used to be married. She divorced him, and we learn it's because he was an alcoholic, right?
C.K. Dexter Haven.
C.K. Dexter Haven. That's a great name, by the way.
It is.
If I was him, I would always introduce myself by my full name. I'm C.K. Dexter Haven. Anyway, 2 years later, he works for some magazine, and his plan involves getting some reporters into her new wedding because somehow he thinks that's going to lead to them getting remarried. It works, so I guess
crazy plan.
You can't complain, but it works. Okay, so this movie seems to be about, I mean, she's divorced, her mother's divorced, her younger sister is going to get divorced at some point,
yeah.
Right? Diane's definitely going to get a divorce at some point.
Definitely.
Diana's never getting married.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, how much time can you spend around Diane? I don't know.
Not to a man.
Diana has a lot of divorced energy. I mean, we can agree.
Yeah.
So here's the characters. You got Cary Grant, who used to be married to her, and we learned that he stopped drinking, right? Shortly after the divorce, he kind of... stopped drinking and has been getting his life back in order. We have Katharine Hepburn, who's about to get married to, it doesn't even matter, Billy, whatever the guy's name, it doesn't matter because he's a nice enough guy, but there's nothing special about him. And then you have James Stewart, which, by the way, this was his Academy Award. He only won the Academy Award once for Best Actor. And
only Academy Award he got?
This was his only, the only time he won Best Actor was this film.
So,
he's a reporter that is covering the wedding, and I guess like the magazine, is it Spy Magazine?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the name of the magazine? They have some dirt on Catherine's father, who's been having an affair in New York, whatever. Is it having an affair if you're already divorced? I can't he kind of do whatever he wants? But anyway, they got that.
Did they imply that, like, this was an affair that, like, was pre-divorce?
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
There you go. So those are your main characters. And so Jimmy Stewart, or what's his character's name?
Macaulay Culkin.
Every time I'm like, is it Macaulay Culkin? It's not Macaulay Culkin.
Connor?
Yeah. Connor. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Connor. So he's kind of begrudgingly there at this wedding, but he does take advantage of the food. Like, he eats a lot of the food, right? Anyway, he gets to know Katharine Hepburn's character, Tracy, and he becomes more interested in her. She's getting kind of cold feet about the wedding. They get super drunk. He comes back with her, carrying her back from the pool after a night of lots of drinking. And everyone, including Tracy, assumes that they had more fun than they should have. So her husband doesn't want to get married anymore, or her fiance. But, you know, there's a wedding going to happen. Someone's got to get married to her. By the way, it turns out they didn't do anything. Connor says that they kissed, that he enjoyed it, and they went swimming, and that was it.
I have notes on that.
You have no? Okay, great. And so, like, she's like, well, there's a wedding. Someone's got to get married. Connor says that, you know, he's willing to do it, but he can't, and it's because the other reporter who's there with him, she likes him. By the way, she's divorced too.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, and which really gets Connor upset that he didn't know
that. He never asked.
Yeah, maybe you should have asked. And that's the first thing I ask when I meet a new
person.
What
a rat.
So, but Cary Grant's there, and he's turned his life around for this moment so he can get back together with Katharine Hepburn, and they get married, and that's the movie. So here's my big question. So this film bills itself as like a comedy. I'm just not sure. I just don't think it's that funny. I think this is a great movie. I don't think it's a very funny movie. This isn't like full of rip roaring laughter. There's a lot more serious stuff going on in this film.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny though.
Because it's no Bringing Up Baby, which was super funny.
I laugh through the, like, I have a really, really dry sense of humor. Probably very much due to this movie. I laugh through the whole thing. Like, I can't stop laughing. It's so funny to me.
Roy, it's fair that you asked the question, but I mean, it's understood in, like, our friend community and, like, our online community that you're not really known for your sense of humor. Not really.
Yeah, that's true. I'm
so like
a wet blanket.
But I'm with Brooke on this one. I think it's got the 40s you know, rat-a-tat, you know, dialogue, the setup and the joke. I think there are lots of I mean, I can't name them all, but, and there's one in particular that I'm going to specifically name later, but I think there are a lot of, like, kind of setups and hits as far as, like, you know, one character saying something that sets up the other character.
So, I mean, so I guess one of the jokes in this film, and it's fascinating, I didn't look up a lot of trivia on many of these films, but I did a little bit on this one. So when Connor is at C.K. Dexter Haven's house and he has the hiccups and Cary Grant says, excuse me, right? So, by the way, what I learned was that, like, that was totally improv, and Cary Grant did not know that was going to happen, and he is having trouble not laughing during that scene. But he performs very well, right? He's right. Able to keep it together.
That wasn't supposed to be in the movie, so I'll grant you that. But, I mean, you got to admit the whole character of Dinah was completely, like she's a showstopper. I mean, she may as well be one of the Marx Brothers.
Right.
Okay.
So. Lydia, oh, Lydia, oh, have you met Lydia?
Oh yeah, Lydia the Tattooed Lady. Okay, so what I really want to talk about, and then we can talk about anything you guys want to talk about with this film, because there's a plenty to talk about. But like, her father is the worst.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk about this because we have such opposite takes on it.
Okay, but so like, wow. he comes out and tells her mm-hmm. that he might not have cheated on her mother if she had been a better daughter. And mm-hmm. that's like that's the worst thing that I've ever, like, that's awful. That's mm-hmm. awful. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. It really it made me mad. It made me really mad. And she kind of like is like sort of accepting of it. But like, I mean, if she wasn't a great daughter, I don't know. But like, that's anyway.
Right.
I
right.
get upset thinking
her
about
dad,
it.
Her dad. I don't know. My big complaint with him is it because it's like the flimsiest of things to say, and the dolt, like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, how could you even say that? But it's just like, he just has the confidence of a man in charge. It's like, oh, I thought of this thing, and I'm just going to issue my old man confidence, and I'm going to, you know, like the secret, I'm going to project it into existence. Like, oh, because Katharine Hepburn wasn't nice to me this one time, that's why I ruined the family.
So, no, like, he's basically saying, remember that thing I did that destroyed the family and that made it so you didn't want me to come to the wedding or see me ever again? Guess what? It's probably your fault.
Yeah. 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 It's silly. But, Brooke, you like this guy.
So, I want to be really careful with uh-huh. how I speak about it because I don't necessarily like her father. I do, however... That conversation that happens between them is one of the pinnacles of this movie to me. Not because he blames her for his affair, which is garbage, right? But when we start to take apart toxic masculinity, when we start to take apart the desires of the feminist movement, when we start to take apart all these different things that are happening in society and where they started from, we can go back to this movie and look and see how toxic it is, truly, to only allow men one set of emotions and one set of reality. And the same for women as well. And in this conversation, he does say some things that are absolutely outlandish. But I, even though he's talking to her and he's trying to make a point with her of looking at herself and experiencing herself and seeing who she is and what is it that she really wants for her life, I really see him as saying, look, I screwed up. I ruined our family, and I can see that, and I am owning that, and I haven't been here, and I came back just at the last minute. Like, these are my things, but I would be amiss as a father if I didn't show you the patterns that you are creating in your own life of holding people to such high levels that they can never reach them, so that you always have an excuse for being closed off and hardened and unemotional and not willing to be vulnerable with anyone in your life. Because if you continue to do this, everyone will always fall short of you. They will always fail, and you will never have love and happiness in your life.
So did he know about – was he saying that – like, was he subtly trying to ease her back into Cary Grant? Like,
I don't think into Cary Grant, but just back into herself. Like, as a father, he's like, you don't have any acceptance for the frailty of what it is to be human. Like, you truly see yourself as someone who is above error, as someone who is above forgiveness, because you don't think you will ever need it, because you are so pristine, you are so perfect. And my darling, if you stay this way, your life will be cold and lonely forever.
So, I will say, and I don't know how bad Cary Grant's alcoholism was during their marriage, but if, like, I don't want to judge, right? If you have an alcoholic spouse, do you stay? Do you try and help the person through it? Or, like, right. I don't know what their situation was, right? I don't know that that she's necessarily at fault for divorcing Cary Grant because
I don't either.
Stop being an alcoholic, right? But and this film feels like an hour and a half or 2 hours of people, like, explaining to her why she's a bad person when she thought that she was a great person a little bit.
It's interesting because when I watch it, and maybe because, like, I've never been in a similar situation to where no one could look at my life and be like, no, you never screwed up, because my whole life is a series of screw-ups. But what? I have been in a position where I have felt like I was so right and I was so justified that vindication was all that I needed, instead of forgiveness, instead of self-reflection, instead of self-awareness. And I think that it's a really interesting movie because she is the lead actress or person in the movie to me, and she's constantly being criticized and attacked and shown so many different, like, and for so many different reasons, right? Macaulay Connor and Liz are there to try to get a story on her, and he's constantly telling her what a snob she is and all these different things, and their whole conversation about being an intellectual snob versus a societal snob is really fascinating to me. But Cary Grant is there, and it seems like it's to try to prove to her that she was wrong, but I don't think that's it. I think it's because he has taken so much ownership of why their marriage failed that he changed his entire life. And he knows that because he hurt her so much, because there was so much damage done, that she's not going to let him back in, because she is protected. She has built up her wall. She is in a fortress. And he needs to help her see that while he was wrong, she's still going to end up lonely and unhappy and making choices that are not in her best interest. Even if it's not him, like he said, even if you choose George the Nightman, Kittredge isn't it? you're choosing him because you're hardened. You're choosing him because I have damaged you.
Yeah, so that's a question, right? Yeah. Is this like her character flaw that she has always had, or has she developed this character flaw because of her experiences?
Both.
Right.
I think the tragic thing for this, and I often do this when I watch these kind of movies, is I see the guy who gets jilted, and I immediately identify with that guy. You know, so like, for me, I'm kind of, like, even though we kind of set him up as, like, George Kitteridge, the guy she's supposed to marry, he's like...
there's nothing wrong with him,
there's
right?
Nothing,
he's
right,
still human.
Which is
he's
kind
the
of
James
like,
Marsden of this film.
Right, but which I kind of see is sort of, I mean, sad and tragic in its own way, because he has his whole speech where he talks about how distant she is and how she's a goddess and she's all these things, and... you know, and that's his fault for doing that because that's not what she wants, but that might be him reacting a little to how he perceives her, which also is a little bit with how she, you know, kind of comports herself as such a thing. And she's like, this isn't me, but it's like, but her action, her like her distant actions kind of make him fall in love with her the wrong way, if it's mm-hmm. love, you know?
Yeah. So I
yeah,
love
totally.
The point. I love the point you've made, Brooke, and so I will say, like, over the last few years, I've kind of had this thing in my own life, right, where I've become really open to being wrong, and I think people feel like maybe that would be hard, and because we kind of live in a society where people, if someone points out that maybe you're wrong, that they're calling you a bad person, right? That people internalize it and they take it personally. That's not the case at all. And I think that it is so liberating to be able to recognize when you're wrong, right? Because if you can recognize when you're wrong, it means you can improve,
right?
You can change, and there's nothing greater than that because we're all on this crazy road, and we all are doing a lot of dumb things, and we all have ideas that aren't right, and we all got to change. And I just, it's so bizarre to me that people get so entrenched in their ideas that it gets to the point where they have to defend their defense of their ideas.
Are you, yeah. Are you sure about this attitude, though, Roy?
Yeah,
you know, I am.
Fair enough.
So that's where I've been living. And I think that, you know, for better or worse, I really, truly feel like C.K. Dexter Haven and Seth Lord are two of the only people in this movie who see Tracy Lord for herself. And they see the way that she has grown up. They see the way that she's changed throughout her life. And I really believe that the two of them are talking to her from this space of, what is the life that you want for yourself? Because look at what you're actually creating instead. And that's why I think it's so beautiful. He says these things to her, and like, in reality, men don't like to feel vulnerable. They don't like to see the end of their life coming, and they do want to be loved and revered and seen as strong and the ideal man that we have created as society, the protector and the provider and all these different things. And when your own children reject you for that, no, it is not on them for what is going on in the choices that you make. But when he breaks down why he has lost himself and why he doesn't, like, this is why I made these decisions and they were not right, but I don't want you making the same for your life. And I really believe that Cary Grant, while he wants her back, also really loves her and can see ownership in why she's making the decisions that she is and has come to try to win her back, but also to just help her create a life of intention, right?
Yeah.
He has all of this dirt on your dad and your father, and for better or worse, I love your family. I always have. And so I'm going to bring these reporters in because they know that I can get in, and maybe I have a shot with you. Maybe I have a shot to help you make better decisions for your life. And maybe I only keep this story about your dad out of the papers, but here I am. I'm going to give it my best shot.
So is it a victory for him if he doesn't marry her, but he can simply get her to not marry Kittredge?
I think so.
Kittredge? Okay. Okay.
I mean, having again, been divorced and married a few times, like, it really is personal who they marry next. It really is.
Damn. Yeah. Well, I it still makes me feel more sorry for Kittredge. But, I mean, did
it does. Poor George. But he had an agenda, right? He never truly saw her. He never truly took the time to break down those walls and to see her as more like his agenda, his political and career and all these things, and getting along with her just fine was just fine for him.
Yeah,
that's
so
just the depth of marriage.
I would have felt better about that. Like, because when he kind of declares his love for her, he does it in the wrong way. You know, he's like, "I want to worship you," and she says, "I don't want to be worshipped. I want to be loved." Right. And so, if there were a scene where he was like on the phone with his, you know, with his politicos or whatever, like, oh, it's gonna happen, you know, once after, you know, 4 hours after the marriage, you know, go put this press release out and do this, you know, I feel like he definitely was presented as someone who really cared for her just in a way that she was uncomfortable with, and so it would have been nice if he was more of a sleazebag, you know.
But I think that's part of the beauty of it, is because he cared for her exactly in the way that men were supposed to care for women in the 1940s.
Right.
So John, if he was more of a
super, like it was genuine to him, because that's what he felt a marriage should be. That's what he felt a family should be. It's something to use and to and sure, I get along with her and she's beautiful and we have like there's synchronicities here that are great.
Well, seriously, weirdly, the opposite of, you know, what we've come to assume, you know, like, you know, it wasn't the same time, but, you know, like the Mad Men era where men were really like, because he is objectifying her, but it's not like in the, it's not in the smarmy way. It's
in a way of kindness.
Yeah, it's in a way, it's like it's in a kind of like overly chivalrous sort of way. You know, it's
he
the way things
her.
Should have been, you know, it's and it's why. You know, I think the opposite of that, where men didn't care about women in the same way, that's kind of why I think chivalry failed, and why we're like, okay, fine, women, you take care of things for a while because, you know, we got too lazy to do it, you know? And so, yeah, I'm just saying, I don't think Kittredge is... You know, like, if this movie were made today, then there would be, like, some hot, like, political... science student at the wedding that Kittredge meets and dances with, and he winds up with her. I think he doesn't. That doesn't happen with Kittredge. I think he's gonna shed a few tears over the next year. So.
Yeah. He's not a villain. He's not a villain.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I think it's important that he's a decent guy. But
and
when
he
they
will be confused by this for the rest of his life.
Yeah. When they do the remake, and Mr. Kittredge is played by Will Arnett. Then it'll be easier to deal with, right?
That's perfect. Yeah, I can totally see
babe,
that.
No, babe!
Babe!
Babe! All right.
Okay, here's another thing. Okay, but let's ask a few things, and I think this is brilliant, because I have a few things like, what is the movie speaking to me about? What is the movie telling me? Which, I say this as a compliment, because I think... You know, because they may not like fly completely with my feelings, which I think is totally fine. But is one thing the movie's kind of saying or communicating? Maybe it's not meaning to. Is it communicating that we cannot that we should stay within our class? Because that was like one of the big things. Like, if a movie were made today, Kittredge would be the hero because he is the low-class guy going for the upper-class girl. But in this movie, it's like the two upper-class people who just remain together.
I can see that, but I don't believe that that is the point of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they are showing that in any class, you can have good and you can have bad.
Yeah.
In any class, you can find what you're looking for, but... Who is it that really sees you, and who have you connected with? And it happens to be the man who she's grown up with, right?
Yeah.
Not a far stretch.
Connor does make a point, though, early on in the movie that class warfare is coming, right? When he like gets on the phone and tells her that the purge is about to begin.
Yeah.
That's That's the Philadelphia story too. That's what we see, like the the riots in the street post, like when everybody like reads in the paper that what, she just married him again. What?
By the way, it's weird. Like towards the end, right? When like the wedding is like people are sitting down waiting for the wedding, and I think you don't think about it until it happens, but like people are waiting for the wedding to begin while like really important stuff is happening outside. Right?
That has always been fascinating to me. Like, if this were happening in real life,
someone would have gone in, right? And said,
it's so crazy that they're all just sitting there. Like, that fills me with so much anxiety watching that scene, because I'm like, oh, everyone is there.
Now, did she have to marry somebody?
Yes, no. If you have the wedding arranged, then you must get married.
This is a real world of Apu moment, right? Like, oh, someone has to get married. It looks like it's you, kind of thing. You know,
but
fortunately,
it
was someone
so
she knew.
Beautiful that right at the end she goes, "No, I will not be gotten out of this. I will do this myself." And she speaks for herself, and she uses her voice, and she steps up, and she realizes like that the lack of like acceptance of human frailty is something that she's never given to herself. She's never given herself permission to be anything but perfect. And it's really beautiful. And she steps up and she says, "I'm going to marry him the way I should have done the first time around. And we're going to honor each other legitimately this time."
I just think
it's really beautiful.
That is really beautiful. Counterpoint, though. She was gonna. If you're going to marry one guy, just a few hours earlier, and then also the same few hours earlier, you were just about to have a full fledged affair with a different guy. Are you in the right space to marry this other guy? You know, it seems like if all three of those guys are happening at the same time, that's worth a week postponement. Yeah.
Maybe we should just pause for just a second.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of validity in that statement, except that it all leads to the whole point of the movie.
Yeah.
Is that it's okay that she was all over the place, and it was okay that things were uncertain, and it's okay that mistakes are made.
Plus the cake's paid for. Right? I mean, there's like... The gifts are there. There is a threshold that has been crossed, and someone's got to get married. So plus, the more I watch older movies, I love Cary Grant so much, and that used to not be the case. But he continues to rise in my esteem. I love watching Cary Grant.
I have a contrasting opinion. I believe I read that Jimmy Stewart was supposed to have the Cary Grant role, and Cary Grant was supposed to have the Jimmy Stewart role. I think
that wouldn't have worked.
It would have worked.
I don't think that would have worked.
Here's the thing that Cary Grant is missing, and here's like I think a problem that I had like trying to figure out where I wanted her to go. I didn't get the sense that Cary Grant had a sense of longing, of yearning for...
Really?
Yeah, I didn't get that at all. And I think that's something...
Gives up alcohol for nothing?
I mean, that's just a plot point, but I didn't see it in his face. That's something that Jimmy Stewart could have had. He could have looked at Katharine Hepburn, and I would have known that he needed to be with her, but I didn't get that with Cary Grant.
So, John, I have a contrasting opinion. So, no, I feel like there's patience, and I think that he's maybe not sure of the outcome, and I think that there's some humility.
Give it to Cary Grant for playing it cool, but I'll always take Jimmy Stewart for the other thing, which I would be able to identify.
No, but I challenge you to go back to the scene where they show up at his house.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that later.
Okay.
I mean,
because when yeah. but just the look on his face when he opens the door, and the like the sternness and the seriousness in his, like, that is all about her.
That's like it's 4 a.m. That's because the night before the wedding, you have a party until 4 a.m.
The morning, the grief, like this is happening the next day, and I am not at the party, and I'm not drinking, and I am staying here in my lane. Like, that is a heavy moment for him. And when Jimmy Stewart shows up there, he lets him in, he accepts that he's drunk, and he's like, okay, this is happening, I can't engage. Like, all of that is out of, like, grief of losing her the next day. And nothing has worked out yet, John, and nothing has been ironed out, and he's there for it, and all of that is a longing for her.
Exhume their graves, reanimate their bodies. I have to see the version where those roles are switched. I just have to know what it would have been like. I have to see it for myself.
So the problem is, if you exhume the graves, you have to make sure that there's no blood in their heart, because they could be vampires. And then you got to burn organs, and it's a mess.
But, this is what we talked about while you were the dentist, Brooke. We were talking about that, so you're aware.
So, no, I don't know. I think the roles were just fine. And I love Jimmy Stewart, but Jimmy Stewart is kind of one of those characters that plays Jimmy Stewart. And maybe he's
you're
not
right.
playing Jimmy Stewart, but he kind of has a character that he plays in all of his movies, right?
Well, this is an Oscar-winning character.
So that's a good,
yes,
like,
Professor?
did he deserve Best Actor for this film?
I think so.
I mean, if you're going to give it, okay. I guess the big question is, what movie do you give it to Jimmy Stewart for? I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is probably, you know, the first thing that pops into my head. You know, a few years after that.
The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised because, look, I love Jimmy Stewart, and I think he did great in the movie. But it just, so, like, when you think Oscar performance, you don't think of his performance. I mean,
you don't normally think of a comedy performance.
Yeah,
but the comedy that he brought to this movie is brilliant. It makes the entire movie. Without him, this movie doesn't succeed.
So I think, wow, someone's watching Return of the Jedi. So
sorry, no, that's my text message.
Okay, so... when I think of like so the performance for Jimmy Stewart is probably Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, right?
Right, because he stabs the senator with a flag.
Because he stabs the senator with a flag.
Sorry.
Oh boy. No. Anyway, I love this film. I love Katharine Hepburn. I love Jimmy Stewart. I love Cary Grant. It's great. All sorts of fun.
I have one question about. Okay, when they asked Liz, like, oh, when she says she's divorced and Macaulay is like, oh, what, you've been divorced? And she, I mean, she obviously likes him, right? Am I getting it right? Are Macaulay and Liz, are they fooling around at least? They're fooling around, right?
I don't think they're fooling around. I think that they travel, they do all these things together, and she is his constant, and he is oblivious.
She's like his Watts, John, and he doesn't see it. He's missing.
Which is why she's so hurt when she looks in and sees them together.
Okay, well...
After she gets her hair done, she's like...
Something... I think they were fooling around.
At least footsies.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's rounding to third.
Okay. So is that your fan fiction for this film?
Well, I don't know. I actually was surprised because there was something about it, you know, and this is the first time I've seen the movie, so I didn't catch it. You guys are both veterans at the Philadelphia
this
story.
This is the second time I've seen this movie.
Well, I thought it was really obvious that they were somewhat – there was something about them that, you know, that coupled them in
yes.
a way, but not coupled them in a way where it's not unusual for him to go after another girl. You know?
Right, and that's why I don't think they were like. I mean, it's 1940. Very few people were fooling around.
I was wondering if it was like, you know, but
Uncle
they were
Willie.
Like liberal journalists kind of thing. You know, it's like, you know, they were living in a different.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't, and so I feel like there was something I didn't write down that I was like, oh my gosh, they're totally like doing something, but they're cool with it, but they're just misreading each other at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of lonely
journalist trips, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
okay. Well, that leads to my other question.
Okay.
Okay, speaking of, you know, conservative 1940s, this is in the opposite direction. Is a kiss cheating? Because actually, so you know what? I say it is. I say it was very emotional, you know?
There's so many, like the movies of this era, right? They all have, like, the, well, we kissed. I guess that means we're getting married, right? Like, that's,
right.
That is kind of the thing in these older films, right?
And that's how I felt growing up in Provo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I feel like then that Cary Grant, for the rest of their marriage, is going to be like, I can't get it out of my head when you guys kissed. You totally kissed.
But I think it's like, it's not just like it wasn't just a drunken kiss. Like, I think it's kind of silly that that they're like, oh, don't worry, you know, we were having this, like, we were pretty much on this date and we just kissed, and so it didn't mean anything. I feel like the cheating starts with, like,
connective,
yeah,
most intimate moments have been with people who it's been around situations like that where it's like, there's something forbidden here, which is what we'll talk about in another movie. And there's all of this connection and emotion and energy and buildup, and that one kiss is enough to stop and separate and walk away. Because it means so much and it's so powerful that I really don't think they could have gone any further than that.
I mean, when you put it that way, it almost seems like if they... like having sex would be like a palate cleanser. Like,
right,
it would like cleanse the, like, it would, it, like the, like the kiss is more meaningful than that in a way, you know?
Yeah,
so, I mean, I was kind of surprised that everybody in this, you know, 1940s movie, like, oh, did you stoop her? You know? It's like, no, I just kissed her, you know? And they're like, oh, it's fine. Oh, that's fine. We've all done that. We all kissed Katharine Hepburn before her, you know, wedding. Anyway, Philadelphia Story. It's a story. Rocky did not appear, but I watched it, so thank you.
No Rocky, no Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah, no Tom. Oh, this is...
not Philadelphia.
Was Philadelphia... it was a prequel to this.
Yeah, so when we were waiting for to meet Kit Kittredge, I thought it was going to be a girl because it was Philadelphia, but it's not. And I keep saying Kit Kittredge. Am I the only one who knows about American Girl dolls? Maybe that's the case. I'm gonna stop talking. Are you guys so? who's doing sliding doors?
I got sliding doors. John? You guys ready?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I took notes on sliding doors and I drew a line down the middle. You know, and I wrote on train is on the left side column. That's when she gets on the train, and then off the train is on the right hand column. And so I kind of, so that's how I took notes. And just for your information, when she got on the train and got her like blonde hair and short bangs, that was like 2/3 of all my notes. Probably 3/4 of all my notes were in that column. And then, like, when she didn't get on the train and she stayed with, what's his name, Jerry, and didn't find out about the affair, that was just, like, maybe 25% of my notes. So, does that sound right? Because I would say, like, the short-haired, the start her own PR firm, that was the main story, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think we're just, like, periodically reminded, like, if she, you know, this is how her life would be if she hadn't found out, right?
Right.
And it's just reminders, because there's not a ton of development going on there. But then, fascinatingly, in the end, that's the story that you're left with, and the only story that moves forward.
Right. Exactly. And that's something I found pretty interesting. So let me just quickly get in it. Goop plays this PR lady, and at the very beginning of the movie, she gets fired, and I think because they're like, you don't know how to talk British. And so they all fired her. And she goes storming out, and she catches the train and she gets on it. But then we're shown in a Tenet type, you know, trick of the camera. She goes backwards and then she misses the train. So we see what her life would have happened if she caught the train, and also what her life would have been if she didn't catch the train. Anyway, you're going to want to catch the train, because when you catch the train, that's when you catch your boyfriend cheating on you with Gene Triplehorn from Waterworld. And and then you have a lot more time in your life to set yourself right, to get over it, to meet this tragic human being named James, who just quotes Monty Python all the time. he hires all his friends to laugh at him quoting Monty Python. So I don't know about this guy. You meet him earlier. You get him out of your life earlier. Yada, yada, yada. Anyway, that's James. You start your PR firm. You do everything right. But ultimately, when you find out you're pregnant by this guy, that's when you find out, whoa, he's married. He's married. That's not his mom on the train with him. And then you fall down the stairs. You have a miscarriage. By the way, they ripped this off in the Crossroads movie with Britney Spears. She fell down the stairs. Not Britney Spears, but her friend. The girl who was in, not Zoe Saldana, but the other one. The one who was in Orange is the New Black. She fell down the stairs.
Anyway. I would be willing to bet that this movie is pre-anything Britney.
Yes, yes. Yeah, Crossroads was a movie in 2003. It was one of my favorite movies that year. But anyway, there were a lot of... They ripped off a lot of stuff from Sliding Doors. And then... As you're rolling down the stairs, you roll out into the street and you get hit by a bus, right? Wait, I'm getting them mixed up. No. She fell down the stairs in the other thing. I could be off. Okay.
She fell down the stairs in the James one. She got hit... Oh, no, you're right.
No. Sorry.
She fell down the stairs with Garbage Face.
Right.
And
right.
Got hit by the bus with James.
Right. Okay. If she didn't catch the train, what happens is she stays with her boyfriend who's having an affair, and who feels kind of bad about it. But nevertheless, he's having an affair with Gene Triplehorn from Waterworld. And you keep your hair long and you become a waitress, and that's when you fall down the stairs. You have your miscarriage, but then you're able to start over with James, the annoying, obnoxious guy who quotes. Fortunately, the one good thing that happens in that good universe is that, you know, you didn't hear all the Monty Python quotes until the end of the movie, when he picks up her earring and she's able to pick her life up. The moral, though, is if you get your life together and you start your PR firm, then you're struck down with death. You die. Right, which surprised me. I'd never seen Sliding Doors before, but that's, you know, how it ends. It's like, okay, the one who kind of picks herself up and dusts herself off like early enough, she actually dies, and then the one who's kind of sad the whole time is the one who lives and who moves on. And I've been struggling with that choice, but I think, I don't know, but Brooke, don't worry, I think I like it better as I thought about it. I think
Here's what I think, right?
Go ahead.
I think, like, the subway Gwyneth Paltrow, the one that made it on the subway in time.
Yeah.
Like, everything that happens from that point forward is exactly, like, the decisions are all perfect. Like, it's exactly how she should react to the affair, and everything is just working out really well. She starts her own PR firm, but that's not like real life, right? In real life, you don't, like, things are messier and they're harder and it takes longer. And I think the miss the subway her is closer to real life and not so much like the idealized version of who she could be if she took control, right? And so she's going to get there. That's what it feels like. She's going to get there, but it doesn't usually happen in a month. It usually takes a long time.
See, I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, it's such a great concept for a movie. Like, when I'd never seen the movie before, but, you know what, when someone says it's a Sliding Doors moment, I know what they're talking about. I know what they're saying. Like, this is kind of like our modern mythology, this story, you know? But with that in mind, doesn't that kind of take away from the Sliding Doors aspect if she is going to wind up in the same place anyway? Of course, just not dead.
I think that's the point.
So it's fate.
Yeah. It's not necessarily fate, but there are things we have to learn and there are things we have to go through. And there are people in our lives who are here because they were either meant to be, or it's been ordained by God and fate, or they've been in previous lifetimes and will be in past lifetimes. Like, there are points at which our life is going to cross, and there are other things that do or don't matter, right?
Right.
We'll get there eventually.
Even though sliding doors diverge our lives, the universe wraps in on itself and we get to where we're supposed to be.
And I think that there's this really, like, the thing that because I used to hate the ending, and it made me so mad. And then I looked at it and I was like, but you have to learn things. You can't take shortcuts through pain and through recognition and making choices for ourselves. And there was so much that happens in the non-subway life where she dismisses his behavior and she lets him get away with things, and she continues to enable this relationship to go in the direction and the pace that it's going in against her judgment, against her intuition, against everything that she knows to be true. She continues to accept his word instead of hers, and she can't get out of that simply by walking in on him having sex with someone else. She needs to use her voice, and she needs to find herself, and she needs to go through these punches until she's willing to stand up and make the choices for herself.
Isn't it? It's insanely frustrating to me to watch her accept his excuses when it's so painfully obvious that his reaction to everything just screams guilty, right?
But That's how my family feels about watching me through my entire life.
But I think the point is, like, I mean, if you suspect that you're being cheated on, I think you desperately don't want it to be true, right?
Right.
Even if you think it's true, you kind of want to put that off as long as you can, because it's like finding out isn't a triumphant moment. It's like the end of your life as you know it moment, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but anyway, the good news is with the part of the version of her that gets to move on did not have to go on that date where James forced everyone to listen to him quote Monty Python.
Right, right. It all comes down back to that, because, yeah, that's...
If I could meet James in real life, I would marry him in a second.
So, I love his accent.
I love him. I love everything about him.
And so, when I hear his accent, all I can think about is that episode of the IT Crowd where... It's my favorite one. It's the outing, right, where the guy says, "Aren't you Irish? I love you, Irish. You Irish are crazy as crack." But anyway...
Did you ever watch the show Gladiators on TV?
No. Do you mean American Gladiators? I loved Blaze and...
and Blazer?
And Blazer. No, there's a TV show called Gladiator, and it's awful. It's all, like, sex and blood and gore. Like, it's... I don't do violence well, and so I never really got into the show, but James is one of the main villains in that show, and he's supposed to be from, like, the Gladiator times, but he still has his accent a little bit, and it's the most distracting and horribly done thing. I can't watch it. It's awful.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So I want to talk about Jean Triplehorn a little bit, who, by the way, I love her, and although it's not a great movie, I love her. Meet Jo Black, where, like, her character is the daughter that is not the favorite daughter, and she recognizes it, right? I think she's really great in the movie, and I think she's good in this movie, and I think I would kind of gave her a hard time. So I don't know why I'm, like, so touchy about infidelity, because I haven't experienced it, and hopefully, you know, on a real personal level, I don't. But I'm just so touchy about it. But but like, her character is probably almost as big a victim as Gwyneth Paltrow, right?
Yeah.
Because Jerry just, like, is just stringing her along, right? He's just keeping her, and yeah, he's never going to
change.
Everyone
talks about what a horrible person she is, but she's not. She's fighting for the life that she wants.
Yep.
She does some horrible things, like calling her in and inviting her over to show her the pregnancy test and these different things. Like,
oh, power move. That was the best. That was amazing.
There were some, like, really vindictive things that she did, but this is also a woman who's been strung along by this man for years. And I'm going to share a story that I have never shared before. But I was dating a guy and found out that he was cheating on me. and I lost my damn mind. Like, I was not myself. I called her. I pretended my name was Sarah, or no, I pretended I was looking for Sarah. I called her. I was like, hi, Sarah there? She's like, no. And I found her phone number in this list of, like, this is very old times, right? On the paper cell phone bills that we shared, her phone number was listed there over and over and over and over and over, and I knew who it was, even though I didn't actually know. And so I called the number, and I pretended I was looking for this other person, and she's like, nope, you've got the wrong number. And so I hung up, and I waited a few minutes, and I called back and asked for the same person, and she's like, you've got the wrong number. And so I hung up and then called immediately back, and she's like, I don't know who you're looking for, but this is so-and-so, and this is... I was like, okay, thank you. And I hung up, and when he got out of the shower, he looked at me, and he was like, oh, shit, something's wrong. So, like, you're not yourself. And
I think that's legitimate, though, right? Because yeah. I think that we can pontificate on how you should react to that situation, but I don't think anyone's going to react well to that situation. And I think it's...
Especially not when you're pregnant from a business trip, like, that you went on with this, that he took you on intentionally and is still lying about you. Like,
yeah. So... We need to get back to the real villain, who is James. Yes. He talks so much. James doesn't stop talking, and it exhausts me to watch James.
Really? Yeah. I've always wondered how men saw him, because he's truly one of the reasons I watched this movie.
I couldn't be in a room with him for more than 10 minutes, because it would drain me so fast.
It's funny, because I know the writer-director of this movie, like, that's him. That's his character that he inserted himself into the movie. And he should have done it, because, okay, we men know that guy, you know? and we know that, yeah, he's charming and girls like him, but we also know that he's, like, where some dudes are predators with, you know, with cologne and with pickup lines and with, you know, abs and stuff like that. Like, this guy, he is a predator with incessant jokes to every girl he meets. He's just going around doing this and just waiting for it to stick, just waiting for a smile, waiting for a charm, and then when he sees that smile, he is not letting up, and then he is a man with a mission. He is not being natural at all. He is just being abnormally on the prowl. That is that guy, and I totally know that guy. Yeah.
Damn. Here, so I don't know. Many years later, and being the coach that I am, I still fall for it.
I don't know if his intentions are that nefarious. I just can't.
It's okay to be quiet, but like he's getting the buzz. Like, once that attention starts, he's not going to stop, and he's just gonna keep going, and he does. So anyway, that's James. But you're right; he is the main villain, but. Speaking of the other villain, I one thing I like about the movie, because, you know, he is the ultimate Jerry, right? Jerry is his name. He's the one who's stringing both girls along.
Jerry's best friend.
Yeah, I really like how, because Jerry is not the usual lot that we see. Usually, when a guy is juggling two girls, he is just like, he is the worst. You know, he is just like, yeah, whatever. Hey, babe. He's like, you know, it's just like, he is that dude, bro. You know, kind of the opposite of James, but also equally hated, you know, that guy that we hate. I like that we get some scenes where he's a villain, and he knows he's the villain, but it is also tearing him apart. Like, he's, you know, commiserating with his friend. He's like, what do I do? I'm too spineless to do the right thing, you know?
Is it tearing him apart? I can't stand Jerry.
Right. And I mean, maybe tearing him apart is a harsh way to say it, but he's not the usual guy. He's like, oh, I hope she doesn't find out about this other girl, you know? Like, he's
his number one goal is to keep things going exactly as they are.
Yes. Well,
I think he wants to have both. And he just, like, complains about, how do I fix the situation? Well, you fix the situation real fast and easy, right? You come clean and you tell the truth and you know... You deal with it, right? And so I mean, he can whine and complain about what a situation I'm in, and whatever, but he owns it, and he wants to keep this awful situation going, and he goes extraordinary lengths to keep this awful situation going. And so I don't have a lot of empathy for Gerald.
I feel like I have empathy for him just because it'd be nice to, you know, to at least have an option.
So he's not like Harvey Dent, right? I think it bothers me more that he's not like. I think it would bother me less if he was a Hardy Jens who knows that he's that he thinks he's good enough for two girls and everyone should just deal with it, right? And it's just this guy, just I don't know, he acts like there's nothing he can do about it and he acts like it's beyond his control, but he absolutely has no intention of changing. So yeah. I don't know.
I think it's really interesting because and he's like a perfect example of how hard our brains work to protect us from things that would actually be in our best interest. Because he's clearly acting and reacting in some sort of like learned behavior to avoid pain for his own self, not for everyone else, but like, how do I avoid the most pain? Well, here's something that I like, I'm going to follow it. And here's something that I like and I'm going to follow it. And I don't want to have to deal with the pain of confronting it or being confronted by it. So I'm just going to keep following these roads. And hopefully, like he tells his friend, hopefully some unknown thing will happen that will take care of everything and bring it all to a head that will make it end. And it's like right in front of him. And his whole brain is like, nope, avoid, avert. Don't look at it. Don't confront it. Avoid the pain. And I don't know that the writers and directors, like, made a conscious decision to write a character who is so perfectly encompasses exactly how our brains will default on old safety mechanisms instead of taking a new path and making choices that are actually in our best interest. But it's exactly what they wrote in Jerry.
Right.
Here is this spineless man who has created a situation that he doesn't know how to end, so he's just going to put his head in the sand and pretend.
See, that's why I like him. And I don't like him because that is deplorable behavior and that's bad behavior, but that's the guy I relate to because you described exactly my whole way of life is avoiding things. That's me. So I guess I
well,
should just
I can help you with that.
You always do. That's why we have you back. I always say it's like, no, we need to have Brooke back. Free therapy. That's what it is. So
you can just bill John later, right? So but right. Speaking of professional services, we reached out to our professional Brit and he told us that officially Gwyneth Paltrow's accent is awful in this film.
Right. Garbage.
Yeah.
I was dating a guy from England and he refused to watch this movie with me. And I was like, but it's my favorite. He's like, it's horrible. She's awful. And I was like, no, it's not that bad. He's like, I will not watch it with you. It's garbage.
Wait,
it's total garbage.
Oh, I wonder if I can find his comment. Because you're talking about Phil's comment on our Yours, Mine, and Theirs Facebook thing, right?
That's a hot place to be.
It's the place to be. Go there. Find us on Facebook if you're listening right now. Okay, I won't find it. Maybe I'll find it by the end. But Phil said he gave this long. He wrote a page about Gwyneth's accent, and he said he talked specifically about her A's. Sometimes it's like A as in father, sometimes A as in hat, and so how they're all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I think he also said, sometimes I slip and I do this thing. And so that comment, it confirmed what I believed for a long time, that yes, all British people are faking their accents.
He also says she over-enunciates her T's because I guess when English people try to be British, they do that all the time. But he says that like it's kind of the opposite, right?
Yeah.
Like they swallow their T's like crazy. So
yeah.
I'm going to find
my
exactly what
he said. My
boyfriend
used to try to teach me how to speak non-American English, and he would get so frustrated with me because I couldn't do it. I just
really?
I was awful at it. Like, say water. I can't do it. I can't even begin. It's ridiculous.
Water is the word, like, when I was in New Zealand. Water. That's how it would translate over into New Zealandese. New Zealand is a very tricky accent. I could never get it. I never got it. I sometimes almost would get some British accents, but New Zealand is very tricky. But but water is the key word because you spell it W-O-O-T-A. Woota.
Woota.
Yeah, that's the key word into speaking Kiwi. So once you get Woota, then the rest theoretically falls into place. I say theoretically because I've been working on it for about 20 years.
All right. Well, do you guys have any more comments about Sliding Doors?
I love this film because it just... We can try to shortcut. We can... And every single one of these characters, not just Gwyneth, is trying to shortcut things in their lives. And every one of them has to face it in the end. And I just... I think it's really beautiful the way that it shows that we could wish for ways around, we could wish for shortcuts, but the best thing that we can actually do for our lives is to have that same self-reflection that I think that Tracy Lord learns in the first movie and apply it to ourselves here and start to make real changes and truly accept that we are wrong, that we do have faults, and that we can only own our own and not the other people's in our lives. And when we do that, we make real change.
Yeah. I refuse to learn that, but I understand.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Well, the last film, it's weird because no one has faults in this film.
It's a movie of faults.
All right. Lost in Translation. Brooke, it's all yours.
Lost in Translation. Okay. I think I screwed up by giving myself this one to sum up.
I think it all worked out.
So nothing really happens in this movie.
Nothing really happens in this movie. So this is a movie where two people spend a week in Tokyo, and then life goes on, and this week is lost.
Yeah, so, like, they share insomnia based on time zone shift, right?
Time zone shift, and I think just general unhappiness in their lives.
Yep.
And yep. So you have two characters who meet who, at any other point in their lives, had they met, it would have been an illegal relationship. and they bond over bad jazz and whiskey and decide to start filling their time with each other because everyone else in their life is so unsatisfactory that they spend a week gallivanting across Tokyo, almost dying, which that scene has always not made sense to me when they're running from the guns.
Oh, well, those are...
Bullets?
I thought it was like a machine gun shooting BBs. That's what it seemed like.
Yeah, it's a BB gun, which I don't know Japanese. I don't even know why they were being chased out.
I don't either. It looked like he was trying to cheat him on something, but then he pulls out a gun, and I couldn't tell if it was an actual machine gun or automatic BB gun. I don't know. But then at the end of the week, like every time that they see each other, they get a little bit closer to intimacy and a little bit closer to intimacy. And I think it's like the really long, drawn out, slow play of the date between Tracy Lord and Macaulay Connor.
Yeah.
It just takes them a week to get there.
So they spend this time building this relationship and building this intimacy, and I don't know if this was ever headed towards a sexual encounter. It doesn't in this film, right? But they invest this time in each other, and they get to know each other, and then just at the drop of a hat, he has an affair with the jazz singer, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The ginger that sings at the hotel, and it's really upsetting to her. I don't think that she thought that maybe she had a chance at like a sexual relationship with him, but that they had invested time to get to know each other intimately, emotionally, right?
Right.
And then he just like does this thing where it's just like it's just instant gratification, and they had commiserated with each other already about how their marriages are, right? And so that scene where they're at the hot pot place, right? And they're just dealing with the fact that she knows that he had this affair, and it's just
painful.
It's just painful. And a lot of this movie is just painful. And like you said, this movie is about loneliness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, Okay, I'm glad we're skipping right to it, because that's the big thing. You know, watching this, because I vaguely remember, okay, Lost in Translation, it's the story of a platonic friendship between two people, and there's nothing, and it's not gross, you know. There's nothing sexual about it. That's what I remember. But watching it this time especially, it's... Okay, sex is kind of all over this, but they just don't have it. You know?
Right.
And so, I mean, was he supposed to, like, hit on her?
Pursue her,
yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it feels like he cheated on her, right?
Yeah.
So, I think that's one of the things that I find really fascinating about this movie, and having myself been in a number of different types of relationships, and traditional and non-traditional relationships, open and closed and whatever, the thing about infidelity is that people always say, well, it was the emotional connection that really broke my heart. It's not that you slept with someone. It's not that you did this or this or this. It's that you had the emotional affair with these other people. And I think that they really explore that concept in this movie, because neither of them seems to have any hesitation for their spouses about going right back to their lives after this week is over. Like there's no, and I think it was really brilliantly done, is that there's this illustration of the reason that they're having a hard time parting is because they're going to miss each other, not because they have to go home and tell his wife, or she has to go and face her husband. But like that's like nothing. They're just going to just slip right back into their lives and move on. And they will always have this aching for this person who they connected to. But they make such a point of showing the emotional betrayal of him sleeping with the jazz singer while they are out at lunch together. So here you have these two people who've known each other for a number of days, feeling emotionally betrayed by what has happened, but having none of that same concern for their actual spouses who are in the background.
Right. So, I mean, that leads to a bunch of follow-up questions. So, I mean, like, if we're talking, you know, going back to Sliding Doors, and, you know, the actions that you take, is this the beginning of the two of them, like, is this the feel-good moment that leads to their, both of their divorces?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's what you're supposed to get from it, right? Because the way I feel about it is that, like, this, when this movie ends, they're both going to just keep doing their thing.
Yeah.
Right?
But I also believe, like, it leaves the door open. Like, here's where it gets lost in translation, is what do you do with it next? What are you going to translate this moment into? This moment of actual connection, this moment of seeing another person for who they are, without expectation, without attachment to it, but just seeing this person for who they are. And then when you go back to your life, what do you do with what you have now learned and felt? That's great English. I've got a lot of translation.
Yeah.
Brooke, if you can't fix that, then geez.
But, like, what do you do next? Do you go back home? Do you decide to do something more? Do you search? Like, these two people will never connect again. But do they take that longing and actually change their lives and become happier and do something either with their current partner or with someone new? Like, do you just accept where you're at, or do you change it?
See, but the thing is, I don't know how hard they're working at their relationships, but the little bit of the relationships we see, it kind of seems like it's their partners that, you know, like, it's out of their control of, like, the type of attention their partners give them, you know? we see Scarlett Johansson with Giovanni Ribisi, and I mean, he seems to be doing all the right things, but you know, there is like some kind of distance that I can't put my finger on. Probably because, you know, he's sleeping with Anna Faris, right? He is, right?
Right.
Okay. and
right,
then,
he doesn't have the hesitation.
Right. I mean, so what is... I mean, what can she do in her relationship? She feels lonely, and she feels young, and she feels like... She calls her friend, right? And she says, yeah, it's weird. I didn't feel anything from the monk, and John is putting weird product in his hair, and I don't know him anymore. Like, that's all she can say. But, you know, she's paying attention to that. But, I mean, all she can do is wait.
I think she definitely goes home and gets divorced.
She gets divorced.
Absolutely. I don't know if Bill Murray's character does or not. Because he has his kids, and he has so much writing on this, and he is, like, actively calling her, and he's like, oh, that was a bad idea. Shouldn't have made that phone call. But also he can see that his wife is tired and she's lonely and she's doing all the heavy lifting on her own, and he's making $2 million by doing this shoot, but he missed their son's birthday, and like these are real pains. Where, and he talks about how things started off so well between them and so easy and so beautiful, and they drifted apart from it. And I think it's because of, you know, his own self-loathing and the fact that he's not making money like he used to, and he's kind of the has-been actor, and he's doing things that don't... Like, I could be at home doing a play. I could be at home actually creating art. But instead I'm here getting paid $2 million to support Santano.
Right. But, I mean, but all of these things, it's funny. I mean, I see
so
these two divorces
happen.
It seems
like it's his wife that's pulling apart, but I think that he has all of the power to change this.
But there's so much like okay, you know, being a person who's just constantly alone and talking to myself all day, you know, I don't know. I have a different perspective, you know, than you people who, you know, actually connect with people sometimes. But like, I mean,
say that
like,
to the woman who's been divorced 3 times. Thank you.
No, you're really good at connecting with people. I mean, you have to do that to get divorced 3 times, right? But like, I mean. It's so weird, like, you watch this and you see all the signs and you see two divorces happening, and, you know, because of these little things, because of these, like, distances that are actually kind of hard to define, but you also look at these other matters, like, you know, Giovanni Ribisi, when he's around Scarlett Johansson, you know, he looks her in the eye, he kisses her, he says, I love you, I'll be home soon. And, I mean, that's a good sign. And you kind of think, you know, someone who's able to do that, you'd think other pieces would be able to fall into place. And then in Bill Murray's case, with his wife, you know, he calls home, he, you know, does some effort, he, you know, he forgot a birthday and he feels bad about it, but you know, he obviously thinks about it, and she sends the carpet samples, and, you know, they're not just distancing themselves from each other. Like, they are doing things, and you think... If they're doing these things, but all these other things are falling apart, how can anybody stay together?
Yeah, I think that's why this movie's so beautiful. It's because I see these two characters, and I don't think that they needed each other to do this, right? But they happen upon each other, and really what they see at the end of it is they see themselves more clearly. And that's why I believe that Charlotte's character goes on to leave her husband and get divorced and create the life that she's yearning for, finding herself. Is she an artist? Is she a photographer? Is she this or that or this or that? I think she goes on to continue to search for that and find it, and find someone who sees not just what she gives to him and her support of his life and doing his dreams, but someone who supports her and being her. The way that Bill Murray's character looks at her and says, no, keep writing. You need to keep writing. That's where your passion is. And I think that, you know, Bob Harris goes home and he looks at his wife and he looks at his kids and he looks at what he's been doing and creating, and he sees himself and his part in all of these things. And I think he stays married, and I think he recommits to his wife, who he is yearning for and longing after.
Okay.
And isn't connecting to.
In his conversations with his wife, I feel right? Like that he does want that, that he is trying to get that, that it, and you know, we see like a week long snapshot of their marriage. That's what we see, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, okay.
We don't know what's been building up for the last 20 years, but you do see that he does want like something there, right? Like he and it's just not working, and whatever's led up to the to it being dysfunctional is whatever, but he does miss something. He does want something.
Is that why this is a follow-up question. I was going to ask it a little bit more open-ended, but I'll ask it close-ended. Is that why he didn't sleep with Scarlett Johansson?
Yes.
Because, and that's why, I mean, because sleeping with Scarlett Johansson would, that would be an affair, but sleeping with mm-hmm. the ginger singer, that would be
expected.
That's a fling. That's expect. You know. That's
yeah. You can move on from that real easily, right? If they'd crossed that threshold with Scarlett Johansson, you can't. You don't move on from that, right? Or it's
right.
Much more difficult to just like. Well,
and I think that's why at the end he kisses her. First, he hugs her, and then he takes her hand so gently, her face so gently in his hand, and he kisses her, and they have this moment of connection and seeing each other, and they walk away.
Right.
And it's not more than that, and it doesn't go beyond that, because it can't.
And then the ending credits start, and we hear Yaz singing, "Hey Baby, Don't Walk Away From Love."
Yeah.
But it's too late.
That was the temp track, I think.
Yeah.
I want to... You guys convinced me, but I will say, the theory I had for why he didn't sleep with Scarlett Johansson is because he respected her too much. That was like my thought on it.
Well, there's a bit to that, right? Because yeah. He's gotten to know her, right? Like he actually has attempted and made the effort to get to know her. That like that there is a part of that, right? Where that's not even like a concern with the jazz singer, right?
Right.
You don't have. He doesn't have to worry about any consequences with the jazz singer.
I mean, and that's a funny thing. I don't know. That's a funny thing with, I suppose, male sexuality is. I mean, it is kind of backwards. Like if you really like someone, it feels like it's dirty to. You know, it's more dirty. You know, to have that intimate relationship with them. It's easier to have that kind of relationship if you want to just jump right into it if you don't have that same respect, which is backwards and weird, but it's, you know, that's part of the psychology of, you know, the way a lot of us think.
Yeah.
Well, all right then. All right. It is.
This was hilarious.
The Lost in Translation was a pretty darn funny movie. Yeah. So, are you guys ready to do some awards?
I can do awards.
Yeah.
All right.
Can you do awards, Brooke? Can you do awards?
Yeah.
We can all do awards.
We can all do awards.
Okay. All right. Best title, Brooke.
Lost in Translation.
John.
Yep. Agreed.
Yep. We all agree. Movie poster, John.
Half of it was in Japanese, so it's perfect. Okay, I'm gonna go with the sliding doors poster, where it's kind of like a slash, and one's upside down, and the letters are upside down, like for the thing, and like, you know, in the dark, the evil Gwyneth is on the bottom.
All right, what do you
think,
Brooke?
Goateed Gwyneth, goateed goop.
I gave it to Lost in Translation. Because that's how I feel in my head all the time.
Like a dinosaur?
Standing there with everything building. Like going behind like the big city, and then there's just this solitary person.
Fascinating. So I also picked sliding doors. I liked the yellow-white contrast. I thought like visually I enjoyed it. The Lost in Translation one is good too, and it probably means more, but you know. Anyway, I'm done talking. So, best tagline, Brooke.
Ooh, come back to me on that one.
Okay, John.
Here it is. Okay, it's the Philadelphia Story, and it's the things they do among the playful rich. Oh boy!
So I picked that as well.
Okay.
I'm going to go with you guys on that one.
Yeah, no, that's the winner.
All right, alternate taglines. Brooke, do you have three alternate taglines for these films?
Oh my gosh, I was not ready for this. alternate tagline. I was going down through the other side of the awards.
Yeah, I do it in the right order.
Lost in Translation. What happens in Tokyo stays in Tokyo.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Sliding Doors is Shortcut Today Doesn't Work Tomorrow. And The Philadelphia Story. I don't know on this one.
That's fine. You did great for, like...
I'm going to say, okay, for The Philadelphia Story, what the kid's sister saw through the kitchen window.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right. John, what do you got?
Okay. Let's see. The Philadelphia Story. Yep, apparently the only story that's ever happened in Philadelphia until Rocky. Sliding Doors... We edited out the story where Goop gets chopped in half by the doors. And then Lost in Translation, I have Tsukina Ichibitsu wa Sonani in Duke. Dake.
What does that mean, John?
Don't you think it'll... You know, it's only fitting that it doesn't get translated? Okay, actually, no, it translates to... Fond glances only say so much.
Okay, so Philadelphia Story, I put Watch Three White Men Like a Rich Girl. So
yes,
Sliding Doors, A Cracking Good Smasheroo, What Ho Capital, and Lost in Translation is A Camera Just Follows Bill Murray Around.
By the way, I forgot to mention why I didn't pick the Philadelphia Story poster, and that's because Cary Grant is totally just elbowing Katharine Hepburn's lady parts in the poster.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, it's a little awkward.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm going to get you. I'll get you again.
Best opening credits, John.
All right. Well, I mean, obviously Lost in Translation. It's just Scarlett Johansson's butt. It's awesome.
Seriously, I got to go with that one, too.
Yeah. It's Lost in Translation. Sure. Nice. So let's see. Favorite technology, Brooke.
The Machine BB Gun.
Oh, there you go. What do you think, John?
Well, honorable mention to the various fax machines that I didn't know were so prominent in, like, 2003 Tokyo. They're all over the place. But it's definitely the interphone system in, like, Helen's house in Philadelphia Story.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
So I'm going with the 2-gallon blouse pocket.
Nice. I heard, like, Brooke, can you verify this? I hear a lot of people say that the reason pockets aren't in dresses is to keep women down.
I've heard a lot of talk about that, too, and I have never researched it, so I can't say definitively, but I also have a lot of dresses with pockets, so I might not be the best judge.
Well, yeah, I think once we realized that, society realized that was in the open, the pockets came back, but I mean, obviously Katharine Hepburn is... She's displaying power by displaying those pockets, I think.
Yes.
Okay. John, what's your favorite character name?
Character name... what number is that again? Oh, here it is.
I don't...
Okay, honorable mention to Macaulay Connor, because it sounds like Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah, that's true.
But there's also a character in Sliding Doors named Cheeky Bloke.
Okay. What about you, Brooke?
C.K. Dexter Haven!
That's pretty good. I chose Premium Fantasy Woman from Lost in Translation.
Okay.
All right. What's your favorite food, Brooke?
Oh, my favorite food... Can I go with the champagne at the dinner party? For the wedding?
Sure.
Or honorable mention to the dinner party for the opening of the restaurant in Sliding Doors.
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, that's good.
John, what's your pick?
Well, even though Scarlett Johansson says this was the worst lunch ever because it was right after Bill Murray's affair, the flat meat that they get that all looks the same. They're supposed to cook it themselves.
Have you ever been to a melting pot? Like, mm-hmm. We finally went like years ago because it was a really big deal. But I still I feel the same way. Like, why am I paying you $100? For me to cook my own food.
This is a horrible lunch. Maybe just cook our own food.
Yeah, get it to go next time. It's like, could you melt the cheese and please just put it in the bag for me? Thank you.
There's a real good chance I'm going to wreck it, right? And if I pay a ton of money, can someone who knows what they're doing please cook it? So, but I also picked it. It looks like what they're doing is a Japanese hot pot. But it's that's what I picked. The Japanese hot pot of betrayal lunch. All right, John, your favorite outfit.
Favorite outfit. Okay, Gene Triplehorn's garter seduction.
Okay, is that what she's wearing when they're spitting champagne into each other's mouths?
Was that? Or it Jim? May have been what she was wearing when she seduced Jerry and then brought Goop to the door, and then she had that on too. And she
was like, okay.
She's like, look how hot I look, and also I might have your boyfriend's baby. That's what she said.
Okay. What do you got, Brooke? Your favorite outfit?
My favorite outfit, I think it's the one where... honorable mention to every outfit in the Philadelphia Story, because I would straight up wear every single one of those. But when Scarlett Johansson is walking through the city and she walks into the monk in her little, not quite a schoolgirl outfit, yet still looks like a schoolgirl in Tokyo, that's my favorite.
All right. So I went with Bill Murray's tuxedo and Clockwork Orange makeup. let's see. All right, who's the best alien, Brooke?
Who's the best alien? I'm going to go with Kittredge.
Oh, yeah.
What about you, John? Yeah, that's true.
He doesn't belong there. I went with Junius. Like, we don't even see him. He's so alien.
Well, I think I would have felt better about it if Gwyneth had said, "Core, Governor!" But she's my favorite alien because there's no way she's British.
Yeah. Perfect.
All right, John, your favorite special effects.
All right. I'm going to go with the beginning of Philadelphia Story where Cary Grant shoves Katharine Hepburn to the ground and she doesn't die somehow. because obviously that was really Katharine Hepburn, and she really fell all the way down because he shoved her down really hard, and there must have been a mattress there, right? But he shoved her so hard that it would have hurt for her to slap against the mattress, the safety mattress that they put on the set.
Yeah, well, that's why this was the last movie she ever made.
Yep.
Well, what about you, Brooke? Your favorite special effect? These movies
aren't that many.
Yeah, there's not a ton of special effects in these films.
I think I'm going to go with Bill Murray's makeup while he's shooting the scenes.
Yeah, okay. So I went... You use this as your favorite tech, but I went with the BB gun, the fully automatic BB gun.
Yeah.
And just like the shooting up all the shops with that, so yeah, there you go. Do you need squibs with a BB gun, or do you just let the actor shoot a BB gun and no one's really going to get hurt?
It's probably a law that you have to do squibs. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Your favorite location, Brooke?
The pool in the Philadelphia Story where they have all of their conversations, like around that pool.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
All right, John, what do you got?
Location. When she goes to Kyoto to the flower temple with the monks, and she does the flower arrangements.
I heard Kyoto's beautiful. Oh man, it's so. I was supposed to be in Korea for 2 years. I was there for 1 year, but Kyoto was going to be our next trip. Doggone it.
Yeah, Kyoto's probably like the Your Name village, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so I just put Tokyo, and it seems like Tokyo would be the funnest city just to like go out one night and without a plan at all,
yeah.
And just do crazy stuff, right?
Yeah. Dang, that would be cool.
Yeah. Favorite song, John?
I have two picked. I don't want to pick yours. Why don't you go first?
Lydia the Tattooed Lady, as sung by Diane.
Are you kidding me?
No.
It's the best.
There's, Brooke, Amy, is that Mann's your song got a pretty good song. But anyway.
It's not my favorite song. There's so many good songs in all of these movies. I love Lydia. I love James when he's singing the Beatles music on the train. but I think I'm going to go with Sometimes for My Bloody Valentine in Lost in Translation.
Oh, good pick. My Bloody Valentine. I also went Lost in Translation, but I couldn't decide between two songs. First of all, More Than This, the karaoke song that Bill Murray sings. He doesn't.
Isn't it brilliant?
Yeah, he doesn't. I mean, it's he has a very distinct different version. It sounds way different. It's nice to hear him sing and think of the original. but also the closing credits of Lost in Translation, Just Like Honey by the Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yeah, that's a good song. Yeah. So, have you guys watched A Very Murray Christmas?
Yes.
So they don't sell a soundtrack, but I made a soundtrack, and I love the songs that he sings. But okay, very good. Okay, your favorite guest star, Brooke.
Oops, sorry, my mute button was on. My favorite guest star. I'm going to go with Seth Lord. He just shows up right at the end. I know you all hate him.
Is that the dad?
I don't hate him. He's going to get... I've got an award for him. So anyway.
Not forgotten.
John, who's your favorite guest star?
I went with Anna Faris. She kind of, you know, is... as serious as Lost in Translation is, I think she added a bit of levity when she comes up to... you know, John, Scarlett Johansson's husband, and just starts karate kicking him. You know, that was her flirtation. So, yeah, I'll go with that.
So I went with Takashi Fuji, who is the real host of Matthew's Best Hit TV.
Oh, Takashi, the real host. That was the real host.
Yep.
Interesting.
That is a good one.
All right, yeah. I'm talking about him later.
Okay, external recurring character, John.
Okay, let's see here. I'm gonna go with... Okay, well... honorable mentions to the insult of Rum Pot, which we just talked about last podcast when we talked about The Natural. And also Red Hair. It's a recurring theme for the past, like, four.
We can't get that rid of Red Hair. Yeah, it's all over the place.
It's all over the place. Okay, but then I just went with... James Stewart. He was also in a movie we talked about called It's a Wonderful Life.
Very good. All right, Brooke, what do you got?
I was going with Red Hair.
That's good.
Very good.
Everywhere.
Okay,
so I'm going with Roland Young, who plays Uncle Willie, but he also played Topper, and at one point we were forced to watch the movie Topper.
That's right.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I could use Uncle Willie or not, because that's... I'm glad you brought him into it.
That's funny. Yeah, he was Topper. I recognize him as Topper. That's right. I didn't like Topper.
Yeah. All right. Brooke, do you have a favorite internal recurring character?
I don't think I understand the category well enough.
Okay, a character that is that you can find in two or three of these movies that we watched, which, by the way, there is not actually an actor that is in more than one of these movies.
Right, yeah.
I didn't think so. That's why I didn't know if it was, like, internal for a specific movie, so I was going to use Uncle Willie there because he just keeps popping up in that other show. But let's go with Red Hair again. Let's go with Red Hair again because there's red hair in all.
Anything you can justify. That counts, yeah. You can do red hair, or you can do Uncle Will. If it, anything you can justify, it, yeah. As long as you can justify anything at all, go ahead.
You know what I'll do? I'm going to go with the female rear end.
Finders.
That's my favorite.
It keeps popping up in all of them.
That's true. Yeah, it's like, yeah, this is pinchable. Yeah. Okay, my...
I don't think Uncle Willie ever saw a hinder he couldn't pinch.
Don't you think he didn't?
Okay.
My recurring character is girls struggling with their man decisions.
So I went with infidelities, which was a theme in all of them.
It was. I'm a bad person.
Yeah. All right. Death. The best death, John.
The short hair goop. Hit by bus.
She sure did get hit by bus. What about you, Brooke?
Here. I had the death of the human ego and pride.
Very good.
So I have James's mother, who when she finally dies, they can be together.
Oh. Boy, if you thought James was annoying, wait till you meet his dead mother.
Oh, man. All right, Brooke, your favorite villain.
My favorite villain is Jerry.
That's stupid Jerry.
Fair enough.
John, what do you got?
I know you're thinking I'm going to say James, and that's justified, but I'm going to go with, what'd you say his name was? Takashi Fuji, the Japanese talk show host?
Yeah.
He is the villain.
Okay. So I got an honorable mention for Uncle Willie's pinchers. I've got an honorable mention for Jerry, and really all the Jerrys out there. They're villains, and I understand the conversation meant a lot, and Tracy learned a lot about herself, but I'm sticking with Tracy's father. Anyway,
totally understand.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Now we'll move on to the best hero, and I'm going to start. It's Russell. Russell is the hero of all three of these films.
From It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
No, Jerry's friend, Russell.
Oh. Okay, right. He's the one trying to talk sense into Jerry.
But... Or he just laughs at him.
No, that's good. Well, my hero is Miss Liz Embry.
Okay.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, well, I say that because, I mean, look, Katherine Hepburn's okay, but Liz is the girl that's the girl whose eyes I want to look into, you know?
Yeah, I totally get that. Mm.
Alright, who's your hero, Brooke?
My hero is Katherine Hepburn.
Okay. Very good. Alright. Then, what is your favorite movie goof, Brooke?
My favorite movie goof is going to be the hiccups from James Stewart.
Oh, right. That wasn't scripted. Yeah.
All right. What do you got, John?
I have a list here. Okay. Katherine Hepburn's mom spells omelet incorrectly. At one point, Goop is holding her cigarette backwards, so she was going to stick the ash in her mouth. And then in the end credits of Lost in Translation, it says Scarborough Fair is written by, like, Paul Simon and Arthur Garfunkel, but I'm 90% sure that they just arranged a traditional song of Scarborough Fair, and they didn't write the song. So,
oh, very good.
But then I have an incorrectly regarded as goofs. James, when he's driving, his steering wheel is on the American side. The correct side, you know, our side. But yeah. I'm wondering if that is a sign that it's a parallel universe, and that's why his steering wheel is on the... And it's the mirror universe. It's the universe where she dies, and it doesn't really exist.
All right.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. I have an honorable mention for the day-night... day transitions in the Philadelphia Story. I think there's a 5-minute period where it goes from day to night to day about 10 times.
Oh yeah.
But then also in Lost in Translation, when Scarlett Johansson's husband runs into Anna Faris's character for the first time, the character's name is Kelly, but he calls her Anna. because, you know, that's her real name.
Oh, good. Good call. Oh, that's funny.
How do directors not catch those things? Like, that's like a cut moment, right?
Right, anyway. Yeah, that seems very weird. If we could explain it away that he just called her by the wrong name because it was a random actress that he took photos of and he didn't really care for that much. But he is sleeping with her, obviously.
All right, Brooke, your favorite funny moment.
There's so many with Jimmy Stewart in that movie. He cracks me up. But I think my favorite funny moment is when he goes to the house with C.K. Dexter Haven. And that entire scene between the two of them, I'm in tears every single time.
That's another goof, right? Because he, like, knocks on the door, or he calls for C.K. Dexter Haven, who, like, immediately opens the door. Dexter. Like, he's just waiting on the other side of the door.
Yes.
Yeah, so, anyway. But, alright, John, your favorite funny moment?
Okay, it's definitely when Connor and Liz walk into the nice house and they're like, what is going on here? And Jimmy Stewart, like, looks at the internal phone thing. It's like, stables? Why would they need to call the stables? And Liz Liz says, well, it's probably so they can talk to the horses without having them in the house. Which I thought was a really great line.
He just turns and looks at her.
So I went with from Lost in Translation when he's getting the direction from the director, and it like takes him 5 minutes to say what he wants him to do, and then the lady goes, be more intense. And he says, is that all he said?
So, yeah, no, and that's good.
All right, best what the heck moment, John.
Okay, I'm going to have to go with the end of Sliding Doors, and I do appreciate the end of Sliding Doors, but also when I first watched Sliding Doors, I was like, oh, don't start that PR firm or are you going to die. So that's what I thought.
All right. What about you, Brooke? What moment took you by surprise?
When Liz says that she's been divorced.
Okay. Okay, so for me, I'm going with the opening credits of Lost in Translation because it's just like it's about 25 solid minutes of Hinders.
Nice.
But I read about that, and I guess like when I guess they were mimicking a piece of art or a famous photo or something, and Scarlett Johansson initially said, "There's no way I'm doing that," but then Sofia Coppola like modeled the underwear herself. And so I guess Scarlett was
Scarlett was like, hey, nice Hinders.
Nice Hinders, Sophia. Yeah. All right. So best quote, Brooke.
My favorite quote from all three is when C.K. Dexter Haven and Tracy Lord are talking is it her dad? It's when he says, you'll never be a first-class person or a first-class woman until you learn to have a little acceptance for human frailty.
That's a good quote.
Very good quote. John, what do you got?
All right, sorry, I have two here. One that represents the most joyful thing I heard in this section, and one that was kind of actually the saddest line I heard. The one that's kind of joyful is when Bill Murray says, you know, once you're, you know, you, the day your kids are born, it's the most terrifying day of your life. But then they learn to walk, and then they learn to talk, and then they become the most delightful people you'll meet, which I thought was just lovely. But although I don't think that's very true, because I've never heard a line uttered by either of you regarding that. So nothing to that effect.
I loved that line, though. It's so beautiful.
It's a good
line.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crap you got to wade through, right? But then you get to a point where the kids they leave, and it's time to watch them, you know, fail or succeed or a whole bunch of both, and it's exciting. It's good stuff.
But it's them leaving, though, right?
Yeah, the best part about raising children is when they leave. So
right. Raving children.
Yes, raving children. That's...
Roy, I have one more line that I have to say, though.
Do it.
Okay. And this is the saddest line, and it's like, I don't know, sad in a weird way, but it's when Bill Murray's on the phone and his wife says, do I need to worry about you, Bob? And he said, only if you want to.
Yeah.
Which is like, I don't know, it's it that's a weird, like, you know, they're not really communicating very well, and that might be lost in translation, but it just kind of shows this thing that, like, really what we want from people is to want the, you know, we want them to want to do something rather than just doing something.
Yeah, you, like, how you're doing, you want that to matter to someone, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you're having a bad day, you need the reassurance that someone cares, that anyway. But that's a good line. So I took from the Philadelphia Story, the time to make up your mind about people is never. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good one. All right, the best scene, Brooke.
I'm going to go with an honorable mention of the scene between Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson at that very awkward lunch. Huh. And the tension that you can feel between them, and like the realness of where they're at suddenly, instead of just vacation land, but just like these real feelings that suddenly come up in their connection. I love that scene. And I really like the scene between Goop and James when they're on the bridge before she goes to call her friend Anna. Mm-hmm. And then I think the best scene between all of them is the one between Tracy Lord and her father.
Wow.
Right before he signs her release to go do underage porn. So you didn't need to honorable mention. You don't need to honorable mention the lunch, the awkward lunch. That's my favorite scene.
Wow.
But my runner up is the scene at C.K. Dexter Haven's house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh wow, wow! You both picked the awkward lunch. That's intense.
What do you got, John?
I from Lost in Translation, I did the bedroom scene. When they're watching, like, a lot of my favorite lines that I mentioned were
when he grabs her foot
in that scene, and he grabs her foot. And okay, I'm glad you mentioned that, because look, okay, she goes up to his hotel room, and you know, I'm not saying, you know, she was asking for it or anything, you know, because they can do that and that's fine, and you know, it would be his responsibility. But when she's lying down in that position and she's touching his butt with her toes, that's the signal, right? Isn't that the signal?
No, that's not a signal.
Is it not a signal? I mean, because she's specifically like playing footsie with his butt, right? So I thought it was a signal. Okay.
Oh,
but anyway,
I could see that,
but a lot
that's
of lines
response to it.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Well, I kind of feel like this is the part where this is the moment they've shared all these things, and this is where she's like, okay, let's do this. But she's not going to, you know, she's still demure about it, you know. So, but that's not why I like the scene. It's mostly the lines that they say to each other.
Yeah.
And he grabs her foot, so that's nice.
Very good. All right, John, who's your favorite actor?
Virginia Weidler. She's young Dinah Lord.
Oh, jeez. Okay. All right, Brooke, what do you got?
My favorite actor has got... Oh, see, you guys hate James so much that I don't want to say James.
Yes.
You can pick
please
James.
Please don't.
No, I'm not going to pick James. My favorite...
I don't hate James.
These movies are so hard for me to pick favorites from because they're all my favorites. Let's whittle it down to Jimmy Stewart.
All right. Well, as long as you didn't pick James, I'm fine.
He won the Academy Award, so
that's good.
It's funny, right?
I do enjoy the character, the actor who plays James in the Brendan Fraser Mummy movie. I like that.
Okay, so my honorable mention is Kate, but my best actor goes to Nao Asuka, who plays Premium Fantasy Woman, who says, "Lip my stocking!
Lip my stocking!"
And then she falls on the floor in ecstasy, I guess. I don't know. But that was a tour de force of acting.
Excellent pick. Yeah, deep cut. I actually have... She's coming up on a future thing.
Okay. The brookiest character is Premium Fantasy Woman. Is that
okay?
All right, your unanswered question. I'm going to start. What did Bill say to Scarlet?
Right, yeah, that was on mine too. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, no, this is big. I think I heard someone say that in their screening when they saw it, that sound was actually really loud, and I think the person said, go back to your husband and enjoy your life, or something like that. And that's what was actually said. Because he did say something. This is the story I know about this. I listened to a podcast where they talked about this. Apparently, Sofia Coppola filmed it, and he whispered something, and it was a line, and it was something that they'd have to ADR later because it was on a crowded street, but it was a line that was said. But then when she was editing it, she liked it a lot better, like, not knowing, and so she kind of edited it that way. But he did actually say something. But what I think he said was, I think you're amazing, and another time, another place, you know, you have a great life, you have so much of it left. I think that's what he said.
Oh, that's very sweet. What about you, Brooke? What did Bill say to Scarlett? So while you're thinking, I'm pretty sure what he said was, all three of those beats were pork.
If you know what I mean. You know, pork.
I think he said, never stop writing.
Very good.
And
very
keep
good.
Going until you find yourself.
Hmm. All right, Brooke, do you have an unanswered question?
The unanswered question for me is and always has been, will James ever shut up? Just kidding. That's not it. Did anything happen in the bedroom?
With Jimmy Stewart and Catherine Hepburn?
And Catherine Hepburn.
Well, if you're asking him, he says no, right?
But neither of them really remember. And his watch was there. Dinah knows.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, you know what? Then, yeah, if they don't remember, then I think it was just hand stuff. But no kissy-kissy, because their breath was gross.
Nobody wants a watch on for hand stuff.
It's 4 a.m.
He took his watch off for hand stuff, yeah.
It's 4 a.m. They probably haven't brushed their teeth in a long time, so yeah, you're probably right. Kissing's right out. Right. Okay. All right, John, what's your unanswered question?
Okay. Let's see. I wrote down a couple that I had to... okay, and you guys already answered. Mike and Liz weren't fooling around, even though they were. and what was the whisper? I'm crossing that off. Was Charlotte expecting an affair? You guys answered most of my questions, except for this big one. Oh, and you guys also answered that Giovanni Ribisi was having an affair with Kelly. Okay, no, my last question that I have is the Lip My Stocking prostitute lady, right? What was the arrangement there? And what? Because Bill Murray did not want to deal with this woman, so why did he have to deal with this woman? Is there a story behind it? Because someone sent her there.
Yeah, I don't know.
Why couldn't
was
he just
say,
you know what?
To say no, thank you. I don't know.
not tonight, because he didn't want it to happen. But mentioned Mr. Nakamori, you know, something, you know. So like someone sent. So it's like some kind of deal where he has to do something with a prostitute.
No, but has anyone ever sent you a bunch of donuts at work
or a prostitute?
And you're like, I don't really want to eat these donuts, but also there's a lemon filled one, so like. Maybe I'll lick it. I don't know.
Nothing you said makes sense. Like, why would I not want to eat a donut?
Because you've already had 12 donuts that day. You're full of sugar already. Like, I don't know.
You send me 12 donuts right now, and then send me another 12 donuts.
I'm trying to think of a day where I had 12 donuts.
I did have 12 donuts. I mentioned this one time. Our guest on our podcast last time, Rhett, who was with us last time, I will never hesitate to bring this up because he challenged me to a contest to see who could eat 12 Krispy Kremes the fastest. And I prepared, and I won, and it only took me 14 minutes to eat those 12 Krispy Kremes, but he gave up after, you know, like 8 or so. And he made the mistake of having like a couple of Whoppers for lunch, but I was preparing all day to eat those.
I had someone bring me a dozen donuts a couple weeks ago, and I ended up throwing four of them away.
Well, mail them to me next time.
Okay.
All right, special awards. The Battle Royale winner between Scarlett Johansson, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Kate Hepburn.
Oh.
Who's going to stay in the ring?
Oh, Katherine Hepburn.
Okay. John, what do you think?
I have George Kittredge. Because Cary Grant said he's the best at throwing a punch, and it is possible he's on a horse when the Battle Royale happens.
Yeah. Hey, that reminds me. Cary Grant took a punch that was meant for Jimmy Stewart, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
What so a gentleman knows. Thing to do. So I didn't know he was in the running there, but I went with Scarlett Johansson because she's also the Black Widow, so...
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, but she has to grow up to become that.
How old is she in this movie? Like, the actress? When?
I read that they started filming when she was 17, and I didn't believe it.
Weird.
Yeah.
Well, now I have to know.
All right.
Okay, let's see. Okay. Lost in Translation was
2003? 2003, yeah.
Okay, Scarlett Johansson, how old are you?
She was 17 in production.
Right, that's 19- what it says in trivia.
1993, she was born in 84. Am I doing the math? My math sucks. That's 19.
So she's 19 when the movie came out.
She's 19 when it came out. Okay.
Yeah, so it could have been... She may have been cast when she was like 17, and they're like, oh, are you going to be 18 in a couple days? Because we're going to shoot your butt. She's like, yeah.
Oh,
like,
boy. Okay. So
and then
the
a year later,
internal,
they shot her.
Yeah. The real internal... reoccurring character was underage porn then.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah, with because Tracy of Tracy Lawrence
Scarlett
and
Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson, yes.
Yeah, very good. Okay, the brookiest movie, and Brooke, you don't get to answer this question. I think it's Philadelphia Story. What do you think, John?
I'm going to go with Sliding Doors on this because I've heard Brooke on a bunch of podcasts, and she... Brooke, you talk a lot about... you know, you have a super great and interesting life, but you also have so many different branches of your life, and you talk a lot about like things that could have gone, things that you wanted to do, and not to say you're not doing things that you don't want to do right now, but there are obviously several different options, so that's why I'm thinking Sliding Doors.
Well, what about the brookiest character? Brooke, who is the brookiest character in these films?
The brookiest character in these films. I almost want to go with Liz Embry.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
That's a good choice. Well, John, do you want to correct her? What's the correct answer?
I have short hair goop.
I have short hair goop.
Wow.
Oh.
Okay. All right. Who's the best man, John?
I have Mike, I guess, but then I have in a question, what's wrong with Kittredge? But Mike, I guess.
Okay. What do you think, Brooke?
The best man in these films, I'm going to go with C.K. Dexter Haven.
Right. C.K. Dexter Haven. That's the right answer.
Dexter Haven.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, he does so much internal work.
Yeah.
See, and that's another question I had about this. Like, what are the statistics of people who get divorced and get married again? And why doesn't it happen more often? Because it seems like taking 2 years to dry out and figure each other out and then come back together seems like it might be a good thing, and it should happen more often.
So, yeah, so I think I had a thought, and I lost it. But I don't know.
But I think they originally married each other as their best versions of themselves. So when they took that time apart, they could come back together as those best versions again. But, like, the brookiest character might actually be long-haired goop because she just put up with that shit. And had she married him and then they got divorced, there's no way they should ever come back together again.
So I was thinking maybe long-haired goop, but I didn't want to say that, so...
It's okay, you can say it.
Okay. All right. You guys, there's nothing left to do it but to do it. So, Brooke, what is your third favorite movie?
In the group?
Uh-huh.
Oh. I don't know how to answer this question. It took so long to whittle it down to these three. I'm going to go with my third favorite movie is Lost in Translation.
Fascinating. John, what's your number three?
I think I'm going to go Sliding Doors.
I'm going to have to go Sliding Doors, and then I'm going to come back around the horn, and I'm going to say number two, Philadelphia Story. Yeah, Jonathan.
I thought you were going to say that. I knew this was going to happen, but I kind of decided it. I'm going to go Lost in Translation, and I knew this was going to happen, that we were going to have this really intense, lovely, incredible conversation that almost changed my mind, and it almost did, but I'm going to put it number two.
All right. Brooke, what's your number two then?
Sliding Doors.
And your number one then is?
Philadelphia Story.
Philadelphia Story.
Very I thought good. Philadelphia Story was delightful. Like, I think my only complaint about Philadelphia Story is it had a 1940s hiss in the soundtrack. So when people weren't talking, you could hear the
Yeah.
But it's like, it's nice to know, but like, I was just kind of smiling and laughing, you know, during those pauses, so that was fine.
I will say that I truly believe the more you watch the Philadelphia Story, the deeper and deeper it gets and the more you get out of it.
Yeah.
So I can agree with that. And to be honest, like the first time I saw it, it was like a big Lebowski moment for me where I was like, I don't understand what the big deal is with this film. And so I'm glad I got to watch it again and got to revisit it. And I still kind of think that way about the Big Lebowski, so I'm sorry, because I know a lot of people think that that's just the greatest movie ever.
I feel that way about the Big Lebowski.
Yeah,
and I think
world
the Philadelphia
pain,
story is easy to dismiss, and it's really problematic. Like, if you just watch it once, and it can just seem kind of silly and flippant and really male-dominated, but I think the more you watch it, the more it comes out.
Well, there you go. All right. Brooke, this was a pleasure. It was a lot of fun watching your very well chosen films, and now we're going to watch some awful films.
Yay!
So
you're coming back in a week, right, Brooke? We
yep.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
A week from Monday. Yeah. Good. So I'm just going to refresh one more time in case people got squirrely with the voting again. No, the fans have decided that we are watching Labyrinth. Good choice. What an amazing soundtrack. What an amazing Jennifer Connell. What can you say? It's got David Bowie in tights.
I just got to tell you, that is a movie I've only ever watched once because it scared the crap out of me and I never wanted to watch it again.
Ooh,
I did have nightmares.
Yeah.
I had nightmares from the scene where those like creatures were removing each other's heads. Like, I used to have nightmares about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We're watching Labyrinth. I absolutely love Labyrinth. I'm excited. Brooke, what is your movie?
I'm sorry. I'm going to go with Idiocracy.
Ooh.
You know, I've never seen that before. I'm kind of excited.
Oh, well, I apologize. I'm
curious, Brooke, when was the last time you saw Idiocracy?
About a month ago.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, I will tell you this. I mean, I don't think you had the same experience I did. Because I saw Idiocracy like 15 years ago, and I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. And I watched it like a year ago, and I did not have the same experience. Not because it wasn't brilliant, but because it just seemed
terrifying.
So much more real. Yeah, and I was just like...
Right.
And it was just depressing.
Oh, I'm excited to talk about it, because I feel those same things about it. It can make me laugh, but at the end of the day, I just feel really, really sad.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, I'm glad you picked it then. This will be good.
That makes me happy. I love doing new movies in this podcast. So,
Really.
What's that?
You
yes,
do not.
Really?
No, you
yes,
don't.
I do.
No, you don't. You never do movies.
You're right, John.
All right.
Okay. Anyway, because I hate watching new movies, we're going to watch a movie I've seen before, but it's been a really long time.
See?
And this movie cost $25 million, and it only made $11 million, and it's got Kurt Russell. And it's Big Trouble in Little China.
Wow.
Ooh.
Okay.
I have never seen it.
Oh, man.
This is a weird group.
It is.
This is an odd Oh, man. So this is going to be good. And since we only have a little more than a week to get through these, I'm going to go ahead and post these probably tonight ahead of John posting the podcast, for which I apologize. I'll make sure that I make a big deal about it when you post the podcast, John. There will be like some good emojis and stuff.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right, the next category that no one had to vote on because it's Flinders Films, so we're going to have to, JB's going to have to tell me what his three movies are by the end of this week, next week. And then we got some categories for JB's second set of films.
Okay.
And the randomly picked category is movies with numbers in the title, which I think is a pretty cool title.
But it can't be sequels, right? Category.
No, no sequels, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, part two or rock, that doesn't count. It has to, like...
Does Leonard Part 6 count?
No.
No. Also because I don't think you can watch that movie. Like, I don't think that's available anywhere. It's like the Song of the South. That's how bad it is. So, but like, what's some good examples?
Like seven? Ocean's 11.
Ocean's 11. No,
seven. Yeah.
12 Years a Slave, right?
Right.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah.
Good.
All right, John, what's your category?
Okay, my category is the one called Primary Colors.
Yay!
Okay. And this is the one, this has some weird rules. I'm gonna make up one of the rules because this is tricky. So we have to pick a red movie, a blue movie, and a yellow movie, right? And so if you want to watch like Blue Valentine, but then someone else picks Blue is the Warmest Color before you and it's locked in, then you can't pick another blue one. You have to pick a red or a yellow movie. We have to represent all three. So then we have to do Hunt for Red October again.
Or Where the Red Fern Grows.
We'd have to do Where the Red Fern Grows. And then, if it's your job to pick a yellow movie, then you have to pick it. So pretty much it depends on what.
Does it have to say the word yellow, or could it be like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Nope. It's got to have the word yellow.
It's got to have. Okay, here's where I'm going to. JR, I'm going to make a rule on this. I'm going to say gold is okay as well, because I was doing some research and there are surprisingly very few movies that have any yellow in them. Like Old Yeller might be one that you do if you want to count that. But hardly any movies with yellow. So I think if we add gold, then there are a lot of movies with gold in them.
Well, what about She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, or The Yellow Sky, or The Yellow Sea, or Yellow Submarine, or Yellow Birds, or Yellow Rose, or The Yellow Handkerchief?
Yeah, those are all movies, but most of those movies are movies we don't want to watch.
Except for She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, because we love John Wayne.
Oh, okay, boy. Yeah, so we could probably open it up to John Wayne again. So if you want to be sticklers, then maybe. But I'm saying maybe let's just open it up to just on yellow only, just because there aren't
as many. On yellow only, so yeah. No one can like say The Scarlet something, right? It's got to be red. It's yellow's the only one where you're opening it up a little bit.
Yeah, we can't. It's not Scarlet movies, and it's not like, it's not, what's the blue? Azure? We can't watch The Curse of the Azure Bonds, the movie. Which, is that, when will that, they should make that, right?
They keep trying to make Dungeons & Dragons, and it keeps sucking every time they make
it.
Yeah,
that's true.
Didn't they do a Rachel Leigh Cook Dungeons and Dragons movie that was awful.
Jeremy Irons, yeah.
Yeah.
It was not good. You're right.
I don't know. I Rachel A. Cook, man. I had a bit of a crush on her.
We all know. Your wife especially knows. You said it all the time.
I say it all the time in front of my wife. She loves hearing it.
Yeah.
I'm sure she does.
She's going to love hearing again the crush I had on Jennifer Connelly when I watched what do you call it?
Labyrinth. It's going to be great.
All right, Brooke, what's your category?
Best anime movies.
Anime. Wow.
Which now is officially category number 106, by the way.
Ooh, that one's going to win, huh?
I hope so. There's so many good ones.
To win. Okay, that's fine. I'm going to have to trust you on that. Okay, now what is an anime
different
movie?
It's different than you're going to, like... You've got Ponyo, you've got...
I mean, are we doing... Is this Japanese animation? Is this what that is? Like, if it's from Japan, can we count it? And it's animated? Or does it have to apply, like, anime rules? Like, where they yell and the background is doing, like, weird lines?
Oh. I don't know how to quantify that.
Well, let's leave it open.
I mean,
also,
we can
also
keep it really open. I mean, if it's from Japan, I think we're pretty safe, right?
Yeah.
So can I add, so not to, so like, for the color category, are we giving a color for the fans to vote on, or can they vote on any movie with a color, with one of those three colors in the title, and then whatever wins, that changes what we have to work with?
I think the fans can decide, they can lock in a color and leave us stranded on the color, yeah.
Got it. By the way, that'll be your pick, and JB, you and JB will pick that.
All right. Make that happen. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I really hope you go with anime. I've got so many good ones.
Well, we know who you're going to vote for there. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, good times. Well, Brooke, thank you so much for coming back again. And we are going to force you to come back again in like 10 days. So.
All right.
Yay. So we had like some serious conversation. We got real deep about these three movies you picked, and next week we're going to get really deep about Big Trouble in Little China and The Labyrinth.
Woo-hoo.
And Idiocracy.
It'll be great. Okay, we'll like that. Okay, so looking forward to that. I don't have much to say. Oh, I always forget, we should say this at the beginning, but if you want to leave us a voicemail, I'm very lonely. I don't know. I'm vaccinated, but also I decided not to leave the house anyway, so whatever. But give me a call at 801-896-4542. I probably won't pick up, but I will play your voicemail on the podcast. So go ahead and do that. 801-896-4542. Say whatever you want. Mention some anime movies that we should watch. Say what we didn't know. Talk to us about, Charlotte and Bob from Lost in Translation, what really went down, what they're really feeling. We want to know. So go ahead and do that number thing.
Yeah, so seriously, this is the way it works. We feature your call, right, on our podcast, and then you're going to be getting like press passes and invited to premieres, because
right.
this is the first step.
Step one, leave us a
step
voicemail.
One.
Step two, yeah. Profit.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
man.
That's how it works.
Well, John, what if someone wanted to listen to the very first podcast that we ever did? Where would they find that?
Download the MP3, free of ads, free of everything, at yoursminetheirspodcast.blogspot.com. You can totally download the MP3 to your computer if you're at work. Or, there's a button there where you could just, subscribe in iTunes or whatever.
Very good. All right. And what's the so honestly, you guys, if you're listening to this but you're not really engaging on the Facebook page, that's where the fun is. I can't imagine if you're one of the three people listening to this, you're not engaging on the Facebook page, because Andy, you are, and Josh, you are, and I said there were three people listening to this. So who's the third?
Brooke.
Okay.
Brooke? Is that true? I won't put you on the spot.
Actually, no. Yeah, no, don't answer. Don't answer, Brooke. We don't want to.
Anyway, but yeah.
I do listen. Not always, but I do listen.
Oh, good.
We'll take it.
Yes.
So, but yeah, come find us on the Facebook page and force us to watch, you can make us watch whatever you want.
Yeah.
That's part of the fun.
You have the power.
Anyway, yeah. All right, folks. Well, looking forward to next time. This was a lot of fun, and yeah.
Always a good ender, buddy.
I suck at it. Brooke, I'm going to turn this over to you. Give us a smashing end here.
Well, thanks for being here, and just remember... Thanks, Bill Murray.
Like, last night, though, was the first time I, went to a restaurant and sat down.
Ooh.
And it was, not that fun.
Oh, John.
There were a lot of people. I'm like, they're, gross people around. They're just gross, and they're... Did you see Justice League? The new one?
Yes, I did. Do you want my take on it?
Yeah, okay.
It's definitely...
if there's one thing I love doing, it's talking to people and talking about movies and stuff. If there's one thing I hate doing, it's any form of anything that could be construed as marketing in the slightest. I will not do it. Like, I can't do it, you know?
I understand that so much.
Yeah.
You might as well know, though, that somewhere in the middle of this podcast, I'm just going to go ahead and plug Best Fiends. Best Fiends, it's a great game on your phone. It's like Friends, but no art.
Okay.
Anyway,
I've actually seen the ads for that.
Every podcast I listen to advertises Best Fiends.